Yeah, 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 come and take a look at the snow. Bright white as far as your eyesight goes. Come and take a look at the fields of snow. I'll just get my coat, then we're good to go. Come and take a look at the lake. Let's have a quick skate before it gets late. Come and take a look at the frozen lake. Put your clothes on, mate, don't make that mistake.
Greetings, holiday shoppers. There are now 272 shopping days left until Christmas, and you know what that means. That means it's time for another episode of Christmas Creeps, your one-stop shop for holiday movies, TV shows, and all kinds of other madness all year round. My name is Joseph Wade. I'll be your host for this evening. Here with me tonight, once again, is my co-host sitting to my internet left, Mr. Bradford.
Hello.
Hello, Brad. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. I had to watch another noir movie, and I'm beginning to think that this is your revenge for anime.
Which is coming up soon, might I add.
Which is coming up very soon.
How's your noirch Brad... your
noirch Bradness?
How's your noirch madness bracket going, huh?
I expected these movies to be better, and they were not.
Maybe we're just picking all the wrong ones.
I mean, it's not a very fruit-filled branch, the noir and Christmas category, so...
It's not a very deep well, is it?
No.
But we have a ringer here on the show tonight. Our resident, you know, expert in all things film noir, Libby Cudmore is here, everybody. Libby, what's going
on? Hi, everyone. Oh, it's good to be back. It's been a while.
It has. The three of us have not had a conversation together in like 5 years.
Yeah, so I believe The Long Kiss Goodnight was the last time.
That sounds right.
And, time.
And once again, just like that, I am so sorry for the cinematic oddity that I've inflicted on you both tonight.
One more time.
Once more under the breach. Oh, man. But I heard Mr. Bradford cracked open his cold one. Can check, sir. What do you got?
I have a Mustang Sally 11 is louder DIPA.
What is
double IPA?
Double IPA. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know the fancy acronyms like Brad does.
Apparently, I've been pronouncing GOSA wrong all these years. I've been calling it a GOSE.
I've kind of been calling it a goose, so you know what? Whatever.
I'll give the gentleman who corrected me this. He did it in the absolute kindest way possible and just broke out the pronunciation and was not condescending about it and was very knowledgeable. And I appreciated that, mm-hmm. that little kind gesture. That's all we have left in these times, I feel.
Was it the snooty bartender that works in the grocery store?
It wasn't a car, it was in a grocery store, but it was not a bartender. So in Colorado, they have the alcohol is kept in a separate section. Ah. And so I was in Colorado recently and I went into the alcohol section and there is a very knowledgeable, but not at all condescending young gentleman who works there. And he guided me into maybe my favorite beer that I've had in a very long time.
Okay.
Nice.
I think it was like a Prairie Ales Rainbow Sherbet Sour Ale.
Whoa.
Yeah, you mentioned that to me. Like, all those words sound like something I would love.
It's something that shouldn't work, and I was a little skeptical at first, but no, it's amazing. If you happen upon it, absolutely grab it.
Yeah.
Sounds awesome. Good, yeah. All
right. Anyways, I've monopolized enough this can check.
Libby, have you got anything over there?
I actually have a cup of ginger tea. Ooh. That I made in a That's What I Appreciate You mug that my friend Mike Sampling sent.
Awesome.
Love a good Letterkenny reference.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched enough of that show that I think it's infected my brain, and I do catch myself talking like Squirrely Dan every once in a while.
I love that show.
It's fun times.
They have a Christmas special.
It's very good. I enjoyed it a lot, and I briefly considered making y'all watch it for this show, but
we should
maybe sometime soon.
Can have Mike on. He's the resident expert.
There we go. Yeah. And then last but not least,
Hey.
So spring has sprung for this drink. I'm holding in my hand a Peeps brand Pepsi.
Oh, you actually are doing this, huh?
And it's not even called Peepsy. It's just like...
Right?
Yeah, on the can, it says Peeps X Pepsi X Peeps, which makes me think it's like a math problem.
Or that, like, it's Pepsi, like, against Peeps.
Pepsi versus Peeps.
Yeah.
Which one is going to give you a tummy ache faster?
Pepsi loves Peeps.
I love Peeps. I do not love Pepsi. And I want to get some cans of it for Fizzball, but my friend Mike won't let us because he's like, it's too awesome to waste on Fizzball.
Is Fizzball the, like, the you hit can, you shake up a can and then hit it with a baseball bat?
An axe handle, yes.
Is this from Sam and Max?
Yes.
I'm okay. Now you're speaking my language.
Yeah, we play it every 4th of July.
Oh, that's awesome.
Come on up to New York and play it sometime. Oh,
tempting. Very tempting.
We have customized axe handles and everything.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Going all in. Mm-hmm. This Peepsy just tastes like Pepsi with more sugar in it.
Oh, that's making me gag.
I know. It's making my teeth itch.
Now, the question is, are you going to finish it or are you just going to...
Ask me again in 45 minutes.
After it's gone warm?
No, after the show.
I know.
At the end of the show. At which point I may need a stiff drink because the topic of tonight's discussion is one hell of a thing. 1947's Lady in the Lake, which is a film noir experiment directed by and starring Robert Montgomery, who in... a fit of madness, or I really don't know what, decided that the entire film should be shot in the first person. Mm-hmm. So, as he explains to you at the beginning of the film, you are going to be solving this murder. You are going to be taking on this case. You are playing Philip Marlowe.
I think I'd do a much better job, honestly.
I mean, I would rather see Libby in this role, but... You know, instead, I gotta do what I gotta do.
My question to you, as somebody who knows a bit about film history, is this the first full-length feature shot in the first person, in this point of view?
I believe it is, because if you watch the trailer, you know, it says, you know, first there were talkies, and now, you know, we're going into this whole new revolutionary... technique. And it thankfully never took off because it's the worst.
I can only think of like two other movies that do this, and I've only seen one of them, and one of them is only half a movie,
and they are
one is Doom,
of course. Okay.
Which my friends dragged me to years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Which rips off this film in a 2-second shot that's extrapolated an entire genre of video games.
Oh boy.
And then the other one was like, it came out a couple of years ago, it was like, it was some dumb title, it was like Epic Guy or something like that.
Hardcore Henry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes,
the stupidest movie Henry. Ever made. Yes.
Okay, all right, that tracks with what my expectations were, so good to know that I had a solid read on that.
Yeah, IndieWire says Lady in the Lake has the distinction of being the first film ever to be showcased in first-person perspective. It's an odd distinction in film history, and not surprisingly, very few films have picked that up and run with it.
It's different. You know, just different.
Especially for the 40s, I thought it was really interesting. Like, nowadays, like, everybody does that because everybody's holding a cell phone and, like, every video is first-person. But like in the 40s, you had to have an entire crew like block out where the camera's going to be so that you don't see the actor.
It's like, hey guys, I'm Philip Marlowe, going to be solving some crimes. Like and subscribe.
Now, I didn't think about this, but now that you've let that genie out of the bottle, would films like Blair Witch be considered? Would you consider that to be the same Not really, because, I mean, the camera skips around between people.
It's the same general idea, I think.
I guess.
But the gimmick there is very much like, oh, someone's holding this camera right now.
Right.
Someone's videotaping this. It's not literally like, you are the main character, which...
I am Philip Marlowe.
Yeah, the closest thing that this reminded me of was, like, Bioshock. Or any point-and-click adventure.
Yeah, it definitely has the feel of, like, I mentioned before, like a first-person, like, shooter video game.
Yeah, that's just nothing but cutscenes.
Yeah, it's just like a mid-90s FMV movie shot in black and white. But that really, like, is the crux of it, because, like, a good third to a half of this film is just characters sitting in a room staring directly at you and talking and
with no soundtrack.
With no soundtrack and just not saying much of anything.
Or giving you the direct information you need. Really, all that was missing was like the ABCD choices to continue the conversation. I played enough Sam and Max to recognize that.
Yeah, every once in a while, they'll try to bring that into like the movie theaters and stuff, and it just never works.
No,
because nobody wants to do that in the theater.
No, I just want to hang out and watch Cocaine Bear. Did you guys see Cocaine Bear?
I did not.
I saw Cocaine Bear.
It's great, right? Like, it's actually really good.
It's fun as hell, yeah.
And it's just like, it's good. It's like, it's solid. I was really surprised.
Yeah, like, it's that's a movie where you don't need to explain why all these people are in the woods to be attacked by a cocaine bear, but they do, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, and like, and you're like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. It's about family.
It really is, you know? I mean, Carrie Russell at one point literally says to a character, like, my name is Mom. Like, I'm the mom here. What are you
yeah.
doing?
Like, yeah. It's
they're
great.
Not going to waste our time.
It's so good. It's like, I want to see Best Picture Cocaine Bear. It's what Ray Liotta would want.
Oh, man. Poor Ray Liotta.
He gave his life for Cocaine Bear.
Mm-hmm. The Lonely Heart Strangler met his end at the the business end of a grizzly bear.
Oh,
that's the most film noir thing I've ever said.
Yeah, that's
so. Hey,
film noir.
How about Lady in the Lake? So, what is the mystery?
The mystery in Lady of the Lake. There's a couple. First, you think you're trying to find that you, being Philip Marlowe, are trying to find Crystal Kingsby, who has gone missing. The secretary to her husband wants to know where she is. Although I guess no, she's a publishing executive. She's more than a secretary. She's secretary in the book. So you have to track down this woman. I'm really botching this because it was so boring.
It's okay. There's too many twists and turns.
Yes. And it reads wonderfully. And obviously we've had some great adaptations of Raymond Chandler. The Big Sleep comes to mind. I know there's actually been a lot of discourse lately about the Long Goodbye with Elliot Gould, which is not my favorite. I'm a real Raymond Chandler purist, which is part of the reason I didn't like this, is because it veered from the book in a couple ways. But meanwhile, you know, the dead bodies stack up. We don't know where Crystal is. And there's a mysterious woman named Mildred Haviland wandering around.
Mistaken identities, double identities,
dead bodies washing ashore.
Absolutely. All the tropes and tricks you would find in any kind of film noir story, they're all here.
Yeah. And I have to be honest, I've read Lady in the Lake several times, and it's one of the ones that I can never remember what it's about. That and The Little Sister just wash right over me. Every time I read them again, it's like reading them for the first time, whereas I can recite whole passages of The Big Sleep and The Long Goodbye especially. But Lady in the Lake, I'm like, well, this is interesting. I wonder where this is going. What's going to happen next?
It's almost more exciting in a way, because you can't even guess at where it's going to go.
Yeah. It's like, ooh. Is he going to track down the murderer?
I guess I'll turn it over to Brad at this point and say, Brad, like, what did you think of all this?
Oh, my goodness. Way to put a guy on the spot.
That's what I'm here for.
While the approach was novel, I was more or less bored after about 30 minutes of it.
Oh, God.
Especially the end drags, really. Like, we can get into the plot summary, but, like, the point at which the crooked cop, like, runs him off the road and he ends up at Adrian's house, and it's just like, when is this movie gonna be over, man?
Yeah, that was I think where we started to really flag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like, that's basically like the 1 hour mark exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. I think at the 16 minute mark, I was like, oh, this has been going on for a while. And then I look, and it was 16 minutes. I'm like, this is going to be a long fucking night.
Yeah, I couldn't power through this one in one go. I had to split it up into two. But towards the end, it was really starting to drag. So I don't have a lot of experience with film noir.
That's okay.
And again, this is why I think this may be your revenge on me. I'm trying to think if I liked it better than the previous movie, I, the Jury, or not.
Oh, I, the Jury's great. I like I, the Jury.
Yeah. It's hard to say. This one was just... It's hard to make, like, a murder mystery boring, but somehow this achieves it.
Well, and I think because there's no... One of the things that makes film noir so incredible is the lighting, is the spooky atmosphere, and this is literally just people sitting in rooms talking to it, like talking directly at you.
Oh, it's funny that you bring that up, because I think the best parts of this film are when Marlowe is alone and doing an investigation and they actually have a soundtrack, yeah. And it's kind of spooky.
Yeah.
That was actually what held my attention more than any person talking to the camera.
Yeah, like the actual first person sequences where the hands are in the frame, doing things, looking at evidence. That's all good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does flag as soon as a character like sits down and starts talking directly at you.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's like any other conversation with a regular person. Like, I don't want to be here for this.
Especially when I don't have control over what to say. And Philip Marlowe gets very... very misogynistic, or breaks out his like little Ralphie chuckle.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the things that really bothered me right from the start is Marlowe is very dry, very witty, very, I don't even know what the word is. There's a cleverness and a brutal charm to him. This guy was just such an asshole. It was what people thought was noir dialogue in 2005 when people started writing for these revised pulps. It's what I would write as cheesy noir dialogue when I was first starting out writing crime fiction. It's horrible. It's just, it's ugly. It doesn't have the musicality of Chandler's prose. And, you know, if you go back and you look at something like The Big Sleep and how Bogart says Marlowe's lines, that's not present here. That same charm is not here.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. Bogart's really been the only good Marlowe. I don't even know who else could do it nowadays. I used to think that Clive Owen would make a good Marlowe, but I think he's almost too dark. He doesn't have Marlowe's wit, and I can't think of who might fill that role. I think, yeah. Bogart was the only one that could do it.
Yeah, see, like, I'm thinking back to The Long Goodbye now, and, like, what I remember of that film is I was more invested in Elliot Gould taking care of his cats and smoking cigarettes than any kind of murder mystery he was involved in.
Yeah. It's like, Goodbye is hard to follow.
It's Robert Altman, so it's naturally hard to follow.
Yeah. There was one night when I was on a writing retreat where The Long Goodbye, Roadhouse, and the next Karate Kid were on.
Jesus.
At like the same time, I think I ended up watching, I turned over to the next Karate Kid right when Walton Goggins was on screen. So I'm like, hello, handsome. And then as soon as that was over, I went back to Roadhouse, a film I have seen something like 700 times. I was like, I could watch The Long Goodbye and finally finish it, or I could watch Roadhouse again. I think I made the better choice.
Yeah. I mean, Long Goodbye, there's something about a beach. I don't know. You're not missing a lot. Somebody's going to get mad about the Robert Altman purists are going to get mad at me, and I'm sorry.
But I'm the care. Raymond Chandler purist.
Go watch Popeye or something. I don't care. One thing that I think we've neglected to mention so far And the reason we're even talking about it is, yes, this is a Christmas film.
Yes, I've actually, in some of the comments, I watched it, it's for rent on YouTube, so I watched it there. A lot of comments about, like, I watch this every Christmas. Like, do you guys not have Home Alone?
You know there are good Christmas movies, right, that you can watch?
People even more jaded and weird than we are have given up on all the other Christmas movies.
Yeah, they're just like, really?
I've watched Santa Jaws too many times.
It's not Bernard and the Genie or Santa Bear or Angels with Filthy Souls.
Exactly.
I still think you guys should do that. That's a great
Angels with
Christmas
even filthier mood. Souls. You know, there's two of them. I'd be down for that. You know, that is actually like a perfect film noir Christmas thing. I don't know why we didn't come up with that sooner.
Yeah.
why aren't you on the show more? But yeah, like
we touched on it on our Home Alone 2 episode.
We did. Like right up on Front Street, Marlo says, you know, this whole thing started 3 days before Christmas. So like the whole mystery takes place like every time you come into a new office or someone's apartment, everything's decorated for Christmas.
Which is not how it is in the book. It actually takes place in the summer in the book.
Right. Oh. So that's like a specific choice they made to change that to set this to Christmas time.
Which is interesting because The Long Goodbye takes place right after Thanksgiving. In chapter 2, he writes, "It was the week after Thanksgiving when I saw Terry Lennox again. The stores along Hollywood Boulevard were already beginning to fill up with overpriced Christmas junk, and the daily papers were beginning to scream about how terrible it would be if you didn't get your Christmas shopping done early. It would be terrible anyway. It always is."
And when was that written?
The Long Goodbye was roughly his final book. It was written, it was published in 1953.
Okay, so proof that the Christmas rush has always been a thing, basically.
Yeah, Christmas. Yeah.
So, always. I appreciate that.
That's the only time I can remember Christmas being mentioned in a Chandler novel. Mm-hmm. So this threw me, because I was like, I'm pretty sure it takes place in the summer, but... but they really were driving home the Christmas spirit in this.
Yeah, there's one scene that I actually thought was pretty funny where Marlo's been arrested and he's down at the police station and he's watching the chief of police talk to his daughter on the phone. And it's Christmas Eve. So his daughter calls the chief of police's daughter calls him on the phone to complain, like, "Dad, why are you not home? You know, it's Christmas Eve. We're trying to put up our stockings. What are you doing?" And he basically tells her to recite The Night Before Christmas to him. So you sit and you watch him just sit there with listening to the phone as someone you can't hear is reciting The Night Before Christmas.
It's fun. It's a good film. This is really fun.
I felt the opposite way about that.
Well, I don't know. At that point, I was just like, I see what they're doing here. They're just fucking with us.
The mission accomplished.
At that point, yeah, I was just like, you know what? Mission accomplished. I'm fine with it.
Yeah. It's just, again, so weird. It's such a disorienting film watching experience. Mm-hmm. I should have watched it while on the treadmill or something so that I could pretend it was Philip Marlowe, like running away from the cops.
Just make yourself exhausted. Get into character.
Yeah. Just be like sweaty and tired.
I also appreciate like after Marlowe gets knocked out and gets dragged back to Adrian's place and she's just like sitting on the couch and they're listening to a radio play of A Christmas Carol on the radio.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's a real one. Like, is that what you could track down or was it recorded for this film?
That's a great question. One that I'm going to furiously Google while people talk over me.
I found a note in here that I wrote. There's a line, I think one of the cops says to Marlo, where he says, "You funny guys kill me." And I made a note. This is me, probably, when Nick Kroll pushes me into traffic. And by this point, I wasn't taking great notes. I was just thinking about Nick Kroll and how History of the World Part 2 wasn't very good.
I was about to say, have y'all seen History of the World Part 2 yet?
It's not very good. He's great. Like, he's
all over that thing, too.
I know, and he's really, really funny in it. And everybody else is, even my homeboy Tim Baltz. Although he gets a good moment of redemption at the end.
I still have not found out if that Christmas Carol is original. I kind of assume it's an original piece to the film because it's just like the closing narration.
Yeah,
it's that's just an one easy of those... thing to fake.
Yeah. I'm just, there's so many versions of A Christmas Carol out there that I'm always like, ooh, is it this one? Like, is it real? Would it be like, I mean, I guess when you're looking for something to entertain you in this slog of a film, you're just like, ooh, I wonder if that's like a regional production that they got and there's like more of it somewhere else, but they only use this tail end and it would have aired on these stations in Los Angeles, like that kind of dumb show.
Right. And if I was like a more committed like film historian, I could probably go out there and find, you know, on like the oldradioshows.com or whatever and just find the actual production. But
we don't care.
We don't care. Nobody cares. It's 2023 and I have other things to do. But I think the best thing this film has going for it is the gimmick. And I think too much of the film wastes the gimmick.
Yes.
Because, you know, there are sequences where it's in the whole thing's in the first person, but there are sequences where like Adrian will walk up to a mirror and then you'll see Robert Montgomery in the mirror and like, oh, yeah, that's me. You're like, that's, and she's looking into the mirror, but it's at the camera.
Uh-huh.
And those are the parts where I'm like, okay, they actually took the time to block out where everyone was going to be and where the sight lines are. So I can respect like that kind of stagecraft, but then it just goes straight back to she's talking directly at me and I don't care what she's saying. Let's just move it along.
She's extremely melodramatic.
Just publish my damn story, lady.
Yeah, and also like those are great rates because even now I've had 4 stories in Ellery Queen. I guess the fourth one comes out mid-April. And I got paid $400 for those each, which is at the high end of what publishers are paying nowadays. And he was getting paid $200.
Adjust that for inflation. And
so it's still, you know, people get $200 for a story in Ellery Queen now because they pay per word. But that is also a major deviation from the original.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one. In the original, he is hired to go find the wife.
Right.
It's just straight up hired.
So they really do kind of get what like the 1940s version of meta when, oh, Philip Marlowe wrote a detective story.
Yeah. And I don't know why. Just have Philip Marlowe show up being hired. His rate is also different. Marlowe's rate is $25 a day plus expenses, 8 cents a mile for gas. And it's only 10 in this one. So, man, you're shortchanging yourself.
Yeah, really.
No wonder you're so fed up and have to take up magazine writing. Up your rates, my dude.
Yeah, but even then, like in 1946, $200, that comes out to like $3,000 today.
Yeah, that's a ridiculous amount of money, even when magazines did pay you.
Is the story even that good?
No, I'm sure not. Especially like it's his first story and it gets published in this magazine. Like, yeah, right.
It isn't the whole framing device. It's all a pretext to have him come in and be hired, I guess.
Yeah, basically.
And have this dangled in front of his nose if he does the job.
I guess, like, but he could just be hired. All I'd say. Like,
yeah, because he's a famous detective. They could just call him and say, hey, we have a job.
It's a strange framing device to set up for no payoff. Right?
And especially for a character that ostensibly the audience would already know. I mean, we've had other Marlowe films. The books have all been published by this point, except for The Long Goodbye. So it's a very weird device to use, given how popular Philip Marlowe was
right
at the time. And so someone going into this film would, and probably having read Lady in the Lake, be like, wait, I don't remember this part. Why would Marlowe be writing detective stories?
Mm-hmm.
So he's also kind of a stand-in for Chandler, I guess. Chandler famously hated this.
I'll bet he did. Yeah.
He was not pleased with the changes made.
Like, it really does strike me as just as the actor Robert Montgomery trying to do a clever thing because I guess he got his opportunity to direct and he said, I'm going to make the most of this.
Bless his heart.
Yeah. I don't think he directed anything else.
Yeah, I mean, Chandler asked for his name to be removed from the final film.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's unfortunate, but you know, that's show business.
Apparently, Chandler wrote the first screenplay for it,
mm-hmm.
and it was, and I quote, remarkably bad, which is like, one, how dare you? I want to know what that script is and how it could have been worse than this.
Right.
Did he do it on purpose? Because he didn't want it adapted.
No, because he had adapted, he co-wrote Double Indemnity.
Oh, okay.
You know, he's an Academy Award nominated screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's just a misfire all around then, I guess.
Guess so.
So I gotta make a correction. Robert Montgomery directed 4 films after this. So somebody must have liked it.
I guess. I also just an addition, I forgot that Chandler had written The Blue Dahlia as well. For, oh, okay. Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Chandler was a fucking alcoholic, so maybe that's why it was bad, but I'd have to go back. I've read a couple biographies of Raymond Chandler. He has my whole heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have to go back and like check, like, what was your fucking problem when you wrote Lady in the Lake, my dude?
I mean, sometimes you write stories because it's inspiration strikes, and then sometimes you just got to pay the bills.
Well, he read the book he wrote, he actually cobbled together from older stories.
Okay.
And he, specifically The Lady in the Lake, Bay City Blues, and No Crime in the Mountains. And they actually featured a different detective. They featured John Dalmas, not Philip Marlowe.
Huh. Wow. That's where you're getting into the point where I don't know who this other detective is.
I've never read any of those either.
So
this is just in my research. But yeah, for him to write a bad screenplay would be I'd be fascinated to read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's worth investigating, I think. So I guess I'm not sure where to take this conversation from here, because we really haven't talked that much about the plot, but I don't know that you necessarily need to.
Because I got a branch and say, nah.
And I hate to sound reductive. It's all the twists and turns you would expect in a film noir story like this happening. Like, this is why there are tropes and things that people come back to, is because they work so well. But
assumed identities. Let's just say that.
Yes. Assumed identities. Crooked cops.
Dames.
Unrequited loves.
Dead bodies that aren't who we think they are. All
long
of it.
Buried, like, secrets. It's all there. And it is a really good book if you haven't read it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I keep forgetting about it, like I'm Michael McDonald.
I'll say this. Like, watching this and like really getting into the nuts and bolts of it makes me appreciate what Shane Black does with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang even more.
Yeah.
Because like, I see the, like, where the influences are coming from, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not just happening in a vacuum. Like, he's doing this on purpose because that's what Raymond Chandler did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm always fascinated in watching bad detective films, because when they're so threadbare and they're so just naked,
mm-hmm.
you can really see what the elements are.
Right.
Especially things, you know, you at some point in the third act, your cop needs to get like hit in an alley. And that happens here. It happens in almost everyone that I've seen.
Right.
Just they have to be taken out somehow. And it's usually, yeah, with a sap to the back of the head. And from the point they wake up, that's where they head into like the third act to solve the mystery,
the PI's journey.
Yes, exactly. Well, I actually did just take a course in like using the hero's journey in the mystery. They're not that far off.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, because at a certain point, you know, your detective has to hit his lowest point where he's I don't want to say in the, you know, the underworld, quote unquote, but because that means something different in a detective story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of the same thing. Like, yeah, here, you know, Philip Marlowe gets run off the road by the cop, DeGarmo, and kind of not left for dead, but left to be picked up by the cops. And he's pretty much, you know, out for the count until he wakes up in Adrian's apartment.
Yeah.
And from there, you know, that's, I think that's the point where you both started to check out. And that's the point where I started to just, I don't want to say check out, but I was packing my bags at that point.
Yeah.
Because from there, you know, we're on our way to, you know, let's finally solve this case. And then it goes on for another 40 minutes of people
talking at you,
talking at you, explaining things that you already knew, but now now everything is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's very frustrating.
It is.
I can't imagine having sat through this in an actual theater.
Yeah. And it's long. It's almost 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. It feels it too.
Yeah. And it's not like a nice tight 90 minutes like, you know, Cocaine Bear.
Right.
It is an endless slog of a film that, and unnecessarily so.
Mm-hmm.
It does not need to be this long.
And it's a lot of the same thing too. It's not even broken up with variety, because I think they're kind of, yes, the gimmick carries, it's the high point, but it's also its Achilles heel in this case. You know, their action scenes are limited by what they can do with the first person's perspective.
The kissing scene?
That's...
She goes in for a kiss, you're just like, oh, please,
really
get him.
Weird.
Yeah.
He goes in for a kiss, and then he pulls back, and it's like, did they kiss, or did he pull back and say, actually, wait, no?
She says, oh, you close your eyes when you kiss, too. So they didn't have to show her big, giant face. In your face.
You didn't want to get the smudge on the camera. Yeah, it's true.
It's very strange, and it's strange how voyeuristic it feels for, like, the, you know, late 1940s. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's also the most boring voyeurism. If you were a peeping Tom, but somebody was just, like, reading the newspaper.
Oh, yeah, like, I'm sure somebody found this very exciting back in the 40s, but I don't know. It's just off-putting in its own special way, because I don't know.
Yeah, it's very much like a prototype of that show Peep Show, but not in a good way.
We didn't mention Peep Show. Oh, so good.
So I think we've talked this one out as much as we can. Should we take it to the crankometer now?
I think we need to.
I believe so.
I think we're all ready to end the charade. So the crankometer, folks, is our patented XY axis for rating Christmas movies. The X axis is how Christmassy the film is, excuse me. And the Y axis is how good the film is. So, gentle friends, Lady in the Lake, Christmas quotient. How Christmassy is this?
You could remove the Christmasness and it would still be the same film, but I think the Christmas trappings liven it up a bit, especially when you think about the scene when he wakes up in the car and the drunk is singing Christmas carols.
Ooh, yes.
Yeah.
I think that would be a hard sell, for example, if he was just singing like a random song.
Right.
If it was the 4th of July and he was humming Stars and Stripes Forever.
Yeah. Or the weird scene at the office Christmas party where the dude that looks like Rick Astley comes in and asks for a kiss.
The little kid, yeah.
Little Rick Astley Jr.
Yeah. So I think it adds a nice festive dressing to an otherwise insufferable film.
I think that's dead on, yeah. Like, without it, I mean, you can read the book to get a flavor for what it's like without, but the Christmas really does add a lot of character to a film that otherwise doesn't really have much.
Mm-hmm.
And I know
it's like when a really boring person from your office wears like a crazy holiday sweater and you're like, well, I didn't know you had a personality. That's fun.
Yeah. That's spot on right there. Agreed. Mm-hmm.
And again, just like with Eye of the Jury, I do appreciate the opening credits being shown as Christmas cards
with a gun underneath.
With a gun. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
American style.
Christmas American style. Hell yeah. So I'm not going to dip this into negative points then, because I think we all appreciate that Christmas is here, that they make use of it.
And they keep coming back to it as a theme. Like, they don't, it doesn't like open with an office Christmas party, then forget it.
Mm. Yeah.
It stays through right up to the fact that she gives him a robe that was meant for the other guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is a delightfully terrible touch.
Yeah, that's not insulting at all.
It's weirdly heartbreaking.
Kind of.
It's maybe the saddest scene in the entire movie, because he just kind of slips it back to his pocket. He's like, I'm not going to mention this. A one?
A one is probably maybe what I would say. Maybe
a one. I think a one.
Here's a question to you, Brad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is this more Christmassy than Eye of the Jury?
Is it
a better Christmas film than Eye of the Jury? Libby, if you have anything to say on here, I'm sorry, Brad, I'm stepping on you. Libby, if you want to jump in too.
It's been so long since I've seen Eye of the Jury that
I would give Eye of the Jury it by a nose, just because we have those Christmas card interstitials that establish the scene. We're very good, right. And I think it uses more Christmas music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
I remembered a lot more like Christmas trappings in Eye the Jury. Not to say that this movie doesn't have those.
Yeah, I mean, one of the characters is a drunk, you know, department store Santa Claus.
Yeah.
There's that.
There is that.
And see, now I have to remember what we gave Eye the Jury. We gave that one. Okay, so we gave that a one.
I think a one is fair. I would say it's almost fair. Equal.
Yeah, we're not gonna give this one the leg up. So then the quality quotient, the y-axis. Did any of us enjoy this? I kind of feel like none of us did.
Not so much.
No, I was. It actually made me a little bit dizzy at first.
Okay, I will say this: I appreciated the gimmick, but so much of the film is like a waste of the gimmick that it kind of makes me not like it anymore.
Yeah,
you know,
that's fair.
Because like I actually love the first person, you know, the driving scenes and all of the first person detective work that he does and all of the stuff that goes into how do you block a film like this, just like the stagecraft of it all, I enjoy. But then when it kind of just becomes it's like you're being interrogated by people you don't want to even talk to. it's no fun. It's just no fun.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, the FMV comparison that you made earlier, I think, feels especially apt.
Yeah. And it's, especially thinking back to reading Chandler's prose, is such a pleasurable experience. It's such luxurious prose that when it's a dull slog like this, it's so disheartening. I tried to watch one of the Philip Marlowe movies with... Maybe it was Powers Booth as Marlowe. And I was just like, I love Powers Booth, but this is not doing it for me. Again, joyless slog. Only Bogart had it, man.
Unfortunate, but true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Alas.
Are we going to say -3?
That feels...
Are we gonna land exactly where we landed with Eye of the Jury, which is a -2?
I'm saying a -3. This was worse than Eye of the Jury, I think.
Okay. Oh, the only saving grace was the gimmick, and even the gimmick kind of lost its luster after a while.
Yeah, I think it kind of hamstrung it in the long run. It was interesting at first, but it kind of lost me after a while.
Right, yeah. And that's
and then
totally
it kept
fair.
Cutting back to... Robert Montgomery saying like, and here's what I'm doing.
Right.
Like it didn't even trust its own gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here's what I did next. But wait, you just told me I was you.
And we didn't even go to the lake. The eponymous lake. It's in the title. We didn't even go to the lake.
Nope.
We get a
not
Greek,
once.
We get a Greek drama style. They tell us what happened off screen. Ugh. Sorry.
Like, okay, this is a bad analogy and I'm sorry. It's like how the new Mortal Kombat film didn't even get to the tournament.
Oh, yeah? I had no idea. Is it all just origin story? I guess they were trying to set up a cinematic universe. Oh, God.
Oh, no.
What a
no, the tournament is the tease for the sequel. I know, right?
Gross.
Why do we care about stuff like this? Anyway, so yeah, a positive one, -3. That's where Lady in the Lake's going to land, folks. Yeah. I hate to say that Norwich Madness is over for the year, but we've pretty much run out the clock on this one. And I got to say, we lost. That's That's my belabored basketball reference for the night, everybody.
There you go.
Good job. So, you tried.
Maybe next year we'll try this again with two different film noirs, and maybe one of them will be good.
Here's hoping.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
There are a solid handful, I'll say that. There's not a ton. The well's not very deep, but we can do this again. I would do this again.
It's surprising, though, because it's such a great idea to contrast like the warmth of Christmas with the grit of noir.
Right? Yeah.
You'd think it'd be more fertile ground.
I feel like eventually we're going to land on one that actually really makes good use of it.
Gonna blow our mind.
Right. Maybe we can make Norwich Madness run into, you know, extra innings in April. And now I'm mixing my sports metaphors. I should stop. But who's to say? We'll figure that one out later. Libby, thank you so much for joining us on this.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And if you would like to read anything by Libby Cupboard, well, she does have a book out. And yes. Would you like to pitch that to our listeners?
Yes, you can read my hipster mystery novel, The Big Rewind. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com. Or you can check out my short stories in Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine.
There you have it, folks.
Yay. Thank you for joining us, Libby. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's so good to be back. Don't forget to check out Joe and I's other podcast, The OST Party, talking about movie soundtracks. Or you can listen to me over on the Misbehaving podcast, talking about The Righteous Gemstones, more crime goodness.
Season 3 coming soon.
God, not soon enough.
Bradford, thank you as well for once again joining me and sanctioning my buffoonery.
Of course. I wouldn't have it any other way.
We have far too many people who sanction Joe's buffoonery.
There are exactly three of you, okay? Well, Bradford, would you like to pitch anything to our listeners before we go?
Nope.
Fair enough. All right.
My name is Bradford. I'm not currently on any social media. I don't have any projects that I can talk about. So thank you so much for listening. I know you have a lot of choices when it comes to media. I guess this is... Thank you for listening to Christmas Creeps is all I want to say. Thank you.
Fair enough. You could listen to me and Libby ramble about movie soundtracks on the OST Party. Like we said, I'm on most of the social medias at Cordial Wombat if you want to talk to me directly. You can email us anything you want at xmascreeps@gmail.com. I would encourage you to go and leave us a star rating on your podcast listener of choice and leave us a review. That would be fantastic. It's coming soon in April. We don't entirely know yet, but whatever we land on, it's gonna be great. I just know it.
But after April Bradford will get his revenge, his satisfaction. Just you wait, Joseph.
Oh no.
April showers bring anime.
Oh no.
Anime's revenge. Get ready. So for Christmas Creeps, I've been Joseph Wade.
I'm Bradford.
And I'm Libby.
Have a wonderful night, everybody.
Good night.
Happy Christmas. Happy Christmas.